Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. It's September. It's the 3rd of September. We got a new month, and we're in the third trimester. Yeah, of the year. September,
season.
October, November, December. There you go.
Season.
We'll take that. My point being that 2/3 of the year shot.
Yeah,
done.
It's
boom.
Over. Yeah.
And then we have September, we have October, and then Election Day. So it's coming very, very quickly. And so now, first of all, I hope you all had a beautiful, if you were able and you were not working and you were not laborious on Labor Day, I hope you had a beautiful holiday, regardless of whether you were working yesterday or not, that you just had a beautiful holiday and had time to enjoy whatever it is that you get to enjoy on days off, and we welcome you to the program. Things have been off a little bit. You know, we always say that during the summer, you know, our audience sort of wanders away, and they do a billion things, and then they come back, and so now people are getting back into their routine, so we welcome you back. If you haven't listened to us in a long time, nothing's really changed.
What will we talk about?
Yeah, it's just really the same stuff. But we missed you. We missed you. But otherwise, you didn't miss much. Let's start and begin with we have a lot of news, a very busy news week end, and a news week. And we will start off on those stories in just a moment. Let me introduce the group. Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer from the Times Union, newly caffeinated, Jay Jochnowitz.
Yeah, the Keurig machine needed a reboot, and apparently there was a manager or administrator code required, none of which I'm privy to, but it has all been successfully achieved.
Wait, did Dina have the code?
Is that who had the code? She said, actually, I don't think you need one. There was a switch on the back. You know, it's
on,
the,
off?
It's
is that how that works?
IT yes.
So,
okay.
Let me just get
on.
This right. You hot-wired the Keurig machine.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, got it.
Probably the Keurig people are on their way here now.
Yes, to find out exactly
the correct police,
how the code was broken.
Get to the all kinds of privacy laws violated. Good morning to you. Thank you very much for being here, Jay.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you. Political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Libby usually with us on Monday,
right.
But we didn't have a show on Monday, so she's here on Tuesday, and we're lucky, and we love having Libby here. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I'm doing okay. I went back to the gym.
Did you really?
Yes.
You recently had surgery in your hip.
Right. I had
and
it replaced.
Then hip replaced about 8 weeks ago?
No, 6.5.
6.5 weeks ago.
Right.
And then, seven.
Yeah.
Almost eight.
Right. Tomorrow is 7. I keep count.
And things going.
Yeah, things are going okay. My knee has seemed to have calmed down some, which is where the real problem was. And I got on the recumbent bike, which I haven't been on in 2.5 months, and was able to watch half of an episode of The West Wing until I couldn't do it anymore. And then I went home and watched the other half. But that's what I do. I watch an episode of The West Wing, and it's 42 minutes. And I used to be able to do 8 miles. During that time frame, and I did 2.5 miles, so I'm still. I need to work my way up, but I'm getting there.
Is it good?
It's,
West Wing.
Oh my God!
I have not watched it.
You've never watched it.
You've never watched The West Wing.
I have seen one part of an episode. That classic
you have
thing
to.
Where the woman.
Oh yeah, that one. That was from the first series when he did a dress down of a ultra right wing radio host like Dr. Laura. But you should watch it. It's great.
Yeah.
And especially now that we're in the election season, it's all very prescient and also very relevant because the issues they talked about then are the 20 years ago are the ones we're still talking about today.
Yeah.
So it's great. I
think Aaron Sorkin should be writing the script of this fall campaign.
Yes,
it might
I
be
think
a little
so.
More enlightening.
Yeah,
than, you know,
yeah. It's just great. This is like my 10th or 11th time through.
There's a great new book out called What's Next? Which is a backstage pass to the West Wing. And it has a foreword by Aaron Sorkin. And its cast and crew and its enduring legacy of service is the name of the subtitle of the book. Allison Janney also has an introduction. But it's by Miss Melissa Fitzgerald and Mary McCormick, both who starred in the series. And it's on the bestseller list, and it's really great. It's really wonderful stories that have to go on there. We welcome Mike Spain to our proceedings, former Times Union Associate Editor. Good morning, Mike. How are ye?
I'm great. I'm really happy to be here with all you guys. Great to be with one of my former colleagues at the Times Union, Jay Jocknowitz.
Yes, for a while.
And Libby, you know, you would often be at the Times Union with various causes you were bringing before the editorial board.
Yes.
So it's like a little reunion.
Yes, it is a little reunion. It's really lovely.
I'm happy to be here, Joe. Thank you.
Well, it's wonderful to have you both here. And just with both Jay and Mike here, you can survive print journalism.
Yes,
good for
this
you.
Is true. They got out right at the right time.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about...
I hate to put it that way.
I think they may disagree with you, weirdly enough.
Well, I'm hoping that I'm wrong.
I picked up the paper in my driveway this morning and read it.
I'm reading it right now online.
Okay.
You know? So.
Yeah. Well, you know, you do.
You do what you can do. Yeah.
That's right.
Let
us talk about what's going on. There's a lot of big stories, and we'll get to these. I do want to talk about these. There's the Russian strike on Ukrainian Ukrainian city in eastern Ukraine that has killed at least 41 people, according to President Zelensky. We will talk about that. Of course, there is what is happening in Israel as rifts widen, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has refused to change course, remains undeterred, and has really doubled down on that situation. And I want to talk about that in some detail as well. I guess the best place to start is just because on this first day after Labor Day, this is the official, unofficial start of the fall
final stretch
of the campaign. I think that's all really out the window with given what the changes that have happened over the last several weeks. But we look at just, as I indicated earlier, less than just about 2 months until Election Day. And a lot of work being done between now and then, as both Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Trump try to shore up their support and see what's going on. So I thought we'd just take a look at the shape of the race right now, as we are done with the conventions and we're done with the first interview and of Harris and Walz. We have the upcoming debate, which is the big deal. But where are we? So, allies of the Harris campaign, including Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, will begin a campaign bus tour on Tuesday focused on reproductive rights, a top issue for Democrats in this election, starting in Palm Beach, Florida, before heading to Jacksonville on Wednesday. Vice President Harris, former President Donald Trump, and their running mates will be off the campaign trail today. On Monday, the Labor Day holiday, President Biden made his first campaign appearance with Ms. Harris since he stepped out of the race, joining his second-in-command in Pittsburgh as she courted working-class voters in an event celebrating union labor. The holiday is the symbolic starting line of the final stretch of the presidential race, and Ms. Harris and her running mate, Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota, made a swing through three crucial states. They had the campaign trail to themselves as Mr. Trump and his running mate, Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio, had no public events planned until later in the week. Mr. Vance will campaign in Mesa, Arizona on Wednesday. Mr. Trump will speak remotely to a gathering of the Republican Jewish Coalition in Las Vegas on Thursday. So even just a lot there to pick apart at, and it's interesting is that the Trump Vance team not on the road more.
Well, don't you think they're in deep debate prep? It's only a week away, and
no, I don't think
that. No.
I can do this. It's no problem. I don't need any practice at all.
Right, right. I've already
I'm the best
done
debater
this
there
once.
Is.
There has to be some going on. I mean, and Tulsi Gabbard, the former Democratic presidential candidate, former member of Congress, has now become a Trump ally and has gained herself a top position in his campaign and probably his administration if he is to be elected to a new term. She's been assisting, reportedly, as the stand-in for Kamala Harris, who will be actually there next week debating former President Trump in their first debate and only scheduled debate at this point, and probably their only scheduled debate. And I think people are gearing up for that, and that may be and may explain why some are not physically on the road and why Trump is not going to physically go to Las Vegas to address the Jewish Republicans group that is meeting there. And it would make sense. Of course, the big debate among the Trump people, reportedly, according to several stories that have been in reputable news sources, is that there's this debate within his campaign about whether to, you know, tamp him down, get him to be disciplined, get him to not react to the charges that may be leveled at him during that debate by Vice President Harris, and to just look disciplined and calm and respectful, and that will really help him. And others say, let Trump be Trump. They say that's why Corey Lewandowski, a former campaign head, is now back in a high position in the Trump campaign. He's one of the ones who really is pushing for Trump for them. Don't tell him what to do. Trump frequently refers during his campaign addresses to they don't want me. They don't want me to say certain things. They don't want me to attack people. They say, sir, it's not good to attack people, but I can attack him, can't I? And then he does.
Yeah,
I mean, and it does seem to rally a lot of enthusiasm among his base. And whether it gets him a little farther with people on the fence, I guess, remains to be seen.
Jay?
Well, the question is whether he needs to reinforce his base any more than they are reinforced. I mean, you know, just what I see on social media, it is just extraordinary. My wife is tearing out her hair over, you know, arguments she's having with former classmates about things that are so unbelievably, you know, not true. You know,
baseless in fact, you mean?
And this is, you know, there's just a he has an army of believers out there who are willing to carry that torch. So, you know, I think a good kind of microcosm of that debate is whether or not you leave the mic on or the mic off during the debate. And that's the kind of the let Trump be Trump versus, my God, don't let him talk. You know, don't let him do that, because what he needs, he's looking for, he's going to need that middle, that undecided middle, whatever it is. And, you know, I watched Lewandowski on, it was either CNN or MSNBC, I think it was CNN. And, you know, he just tried to bully his way through the interview, not letting the person talk at all. And I don't think the American people, you know, the undecided people in particular, are going to like to see that at a debate again, the stalking Hillary around the stage. I'm not a puppet, you're a puppet. You know, that all that nonsense, if he can, it's one of the reasons Biden did so badly in the debate was he didn't have Trump interrupting him, which probably would have helped at that point. But it certainly helped Trump.
Oh, I hope the two candidates argue about golf scores again.
Yeah. I think that, sure, let Trump be Trump. Absolutely, I'm all for it.
Well, I don't, you know, let Trump be Trump, but I don't think you'd have a choice, right? I mean,
right.
He's not disciplined enough to do, no. Well, first of all, I don't even know, I think that's probably unfair. I think he has an instinct to know what his people want and what they want to see, and he's extremely effective at doing that, so why screw it up? And I do get that in the sense of you go out, you have this tremendous response, you're freewheeling for 90 minutes, and you you give them the greatest hits.
And Trump was talking about this. There was an article about this very thing the other day about, I can't remember the name, The Weave, I think he called it.
Yes.
The ability to have 9 different topics going on all at once. He's a master of
right.
it.
Right.
And, you know, in a sense, he's not wrong.
He's not.
He does bring it all home. It all, in a kind of weird way, ends up making sense. He hits the highlights, the best of Trump, and he gets through 90 minutes, 2 hours of a thing.
During the break, I want to talk with you all about that article because I have problems with it. Okay.
Fair enough.
Libby.
Yes. Well, look, the man is going to...
What do you think I want from you right now?
Oh, okay, fine.
Deep political analysis.
Right, deep political analysis. The man is
Turn
gonna,
it on, Sunshine.
Okay, fine. The man's going to do what he wants to do because that's what he's always done, whether it's on a debate stage or in a dressing room, right? In a department store,
yeah.
Right? He's
going to
do what he's going to do because he thinks he can get away with everything. Now, I do think... That the middle, whatever's left of it, is getting sick and tired of it. He's having trouble filling arenas. People are not coming out like they did in 2016 or in 2020. His rambling, his explanation of his rambling, you know, which is what you were talking about. I was talking to somebody about it yesterday. It was like, oh, yeah, here we go, all the way around Robin Hood's barn, and then I eventually get to the point, but then I leave again. And then I come back, but then I eventually leave, and then I'll come back. I mean, you know, it takes, I don't want to say a fine mind, but whoever can follow this. And I don't think anybody in the audience really follows any of it. I think they're just
like the
rah,
jokes.
Rah, rah. Yeah,
they like the jokes.
They like the demeaning of people. They like the insults.
30 seconds.
You know, they like all of that stuff, and that's what they're coming for. They're not coming for policy, that's for sure. These people don't understand policy. They don't really care about policy except for making sure women don't have control over their own bodies and that people of color are kept in a slave-like position. Those are their two policies.
That's it. We'll take a break.
Okay.
We'll get back. We'll talk about much more from Libby and from the whole group. We'll do all of that after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday. It is the 3rd of September, and we welcome you, J.J. Ochnowitz, Libby Post, and Mike Spain, making up our panel this morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, and we will get to your letters in just a moment. So here is another, we're not changing the topic, I'm just adding another aspect to it. There is an interesting article in the Washington Post today about this idea of something that is called the 1776 mm-hmm. Commission. This was something that it was summer 2020. President Trump phoned his education secretary, Betsy DeVos. Remember her?
Oh, God.
DeVos's focus that summer was the mass disruption the pandemic had inflicted on students. But Trump was worked up about something else. The 1619 Project, a set of essays published in the New York Times that centered slavery in understanding the founding of the nation in a what DeVos calls rant. Trump wanted to know how the administration could ban it from classrooms. I had to remind him that the United States does not have a national curriculum for good reason, DeVos wrote in her memoir, Hostages No More. She told him directly the federal government can't ban the 1619 Project. That wasn't what Trump wanted to hear, and he didn't drop the idea of a national curriculum. Soon he announced a new 1776 commission aimed at telling a far more patriotic story about the place slavery and racism have played in America's history. If Trump had scant understanding of curriculum development, he saw clearly how Republicans could use the politics of race and education to inflame passions. The commission ultimately produced a 41-page report on patriotic education that was posted on the White House website 2 days before Trump left office, so conveniently right after January 6th.
Mm-hmm.
And it was disbanded by President Biden as one of his first acts in office. The little-noticed story of how Trump personally commissioned this initiative in its final months as president shows his instinct for spotting and stoking a simmering culture war issue, the same approach that has shaped his political comeback in the years since he left office. It's also a granular example, writes the Post, of how Trump's impulse to use federal power expansively to execute his political goals was at times thwarted in his first term by aides who took a more traditional conservative view of the role of government. And this was the sentence that made me want to talk about this with you all today. So I'll go back. It offers a granular example of how Trump's impulse to use federal power expansively to execute his political goals was at times thwarted in his first term, and what he might achieve should he return to the White House without any such guardrails.
It's called fascism. They talk in this about fascism and whether or not they talked about it in the report and used it as, you know, calling some left-wing stuff fascist and that sort of thing. But look at how many people from his administration are backing Harris and not endorsing him. And you will see that the guardrails that they were won't be there anymore. And he is going to have a bunch of bootlicking sycophants in these positions who will say, okay, whatever you want. And they don't care because all they're interested in is their own personal power and the fact that, oh, look, I'm in the Trump White House. And so I do think that, you know, he is going to be unhinged and if he is elected and will wreak havoc across many, many parts of our society, including education. But this really does go up against the classical conservative notion that localities should control the education of their children. And now he's saying, no, I want them all to be taught the 1776 commission and that slavery really wasn't that bad, right? They got their 3 square meals a day. They had a roof over their
heads.
And
training.
Right? And some job training. So what's the problem here? Yeah. And that this country wasn't built on slavery. And we all know it was. Even New York. I mean, I remember watching 1776 when I was a kid, right? And even New York didn't come on board right away because of the amount of slave owners we had in this state. And we know it from here. I mean, we know Schuylers had slaves and other people. But it's just that he would like to, in some respects, return to that time when people were indentured servants, right? And he sees his workers as those types of folks. But I think there will not be any guardrails because nobody of any substance is going to work for this man.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Jay.
You know, I'm still getting over Betty DeVos being the hero of her own personal story.
There is that.
There's a lot of that going on.
It's, all right. So that aside, it does seem as if there was an education department and infrastructure there to say, no, we don't go for this. We don't want to do it. And this 41-page report was cobbled together by a college administrator who was brought in as kind of the guy to put this together, and then I guess his president came in as as chairman of the board, and they got a bunch of people together, and there were people on there that were troubled by this final slipshod report that was done. To Libby's point. For all Donald Trump's denials about the about Project 2025, I come back to the fact that part of Project 2025 is that the Heritage Foundation is taking job applications for this. They are preparing whether Trump is endorsing this or not, they are preparing on day one to hand him a federal workforce made up of true believers. And that's how you accomplish stuff like this. You throw out all the civil servants. You throw out all the career professionals. You throw out everybody that would say no because they should say no. And you put in all these people who are just sycophants and Kool-Aid drinkers. And you create a government out of this. It's terrifying. And this is exactly how you get a fascistic government. You just get rid of all the
right. And if you have, you talked about the college. It's Hillsdale College, right? I get their stuff for whatever reason. I guess because I'm a teacher.
Because I'm on their mailing list.
Yeah.
I'm on their mailing list.
Yeah, right. Well, I think many of us are. And they're a conservative Christian school, and they even push back against this. And if they're going to push back, and I get their mailings, and they're absolutely horrific in terms of their. Where they are and what they want to talk about. But if they're pushing back against this, then you know this is like really fringe.
Well, when you can use your discount code to get stuff from the Hillsdale College using Mark Levin.
Yeah, right. There is that.
You're in a bad place.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Mike.
Yeah, I think it talks a little bit about the whole way that people, politicians, leaders try to rewrite history to their own, with their own, and to promote their own selves, basically, and to promote their own ideals. This is weird, but this reminded me, reading the 1776 report, the whole story about it. It reminded me of back in the early 1990s. People may not recall, but Disney announced plans to open a theme park near the Manassas, Virginia battleground and memorial. And it was going to have several themes that they were going to include in it that basically covered different phases of American history. Historians went nuts. They just came out in droves to say, don't Disney-ize, don't do to our American tale and our American lore, don't turn it into something with Donald and Mickey and this stuff, please, let history be history.
And they said, it's going to be a much larger version of the Hall of Presidents that is at Disney. Mm-hmm. And everyone said, that's what we're afraid of.
Yeah, exactly. Ladies and gentlemen, the presidents of the United States. Right. Yeah. And so I guess I bring that up because, people will always try to manipulate history. One of the local a guy who lives locally who's a great history writer is Bruce Dierstein. And he wrote recently a piece for the Times Union and he made the argument that, it's a time to put history back into the classroom. And he talked about how policies in New York have decreased the amount of history being taught, and that's been mirrored across the country. We don't teach enough history. So if we're going to start teaching history, let's make darn sure we're teaching the right history and not letting political influence get into it. I mean, in some states, Thomas Jefferson isn't even in the textbooks because, they just don't want to deal with it. We have to learn to look at our history fairly and see that even our founding fathers, the ones we hold so highly, like Alexander Hamilton and George Washington, who were so enlightened in so many ways, and Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, were slave holders. And it's a recognition that people are flawed and people evolve and countries evolve, and look at what we've evolved to and look what we can evolve to. And that is really what you get from history. But, this was just an attempt to rewrite the 1619 report that the New York Times had sponsored, which did tell the hard truth about slavery and how important it was to the development of the U.S.
But also had problems of its
That was flawed, too. And they did correct it. And they did rewrite part of it.
And I think that is, kind of part of what the bigger issue here is. I mean, Trump is Trump, and this whole effort was really a bad thing. It was an insidious thing to do. And, what DeSantis is doing in Florida, what Abbott's doing in Texas and the Texas Board of Education, all this is offensive. But... bridge you choose. There's something to be said a lot to be said for governing from the middle in this country. Mm-hmm. And Trump was governing from the right. And there are people in the Democratic Party as well who I think want to govern from the, very far left. Mm-hmm. And so when we're having these arguments about history, when we're having these arguments about race, when we're having these arguments about immigration, Gaza, all the things we're doing, somewhere there is a middle ground. That is not a wishy-washy place to be. It is a place where we can all coexist. And Trump did not want to coexist. He wanted to just get reelected and reelected and reelected, And he wanted to keep stoking his crowds, and he wanted to keep pulling in the money. And that is what, unfortunately, this is all about. This is not smart governing. It was political governing or ideological governing. And I hope that somehow this race define herself, that Harris doesn't define herself so far to the left of Trump that she's unpalatable to the middle.
I don't think she will. Look, this is a center right country. It always has been, mm-hmm. and probably always will be. And you need the far right and the far left. Well, I don't want to say need, but they push against the middle to impact policy. There's no two ways about it. But I don't think she will do that. I think she understands politics, and the people around her certainly understand presidential politics and presidential elections. And while, we all might want to, not be happy with Bill Clinton at times because of how he moved the Democratic Party to center right. Mm-hmm. It enabled us to reelect him, elect Obama, elect Joe Biden, and it'll enable us again to elect Kamala Harris. It is who we are as a nation. He talked about in this thing, they talked about the 250th anniversary of the founding of the country and blah, 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 blah. Well, I was the class of 1976. We were the bicentennial class when I graduated high school. And it was all of these great celebrations about America. And it was lovely in a sense, and Lee Iacocca was doing his thing and the Statue of Liberty and the whole nine yards.
Great fireworks.
Yeah, great fireworks. Terrific fireworks. But they want to take this opportunity in 2026, which will also be my 50th high school reunion, to rewrite what American history is from the right, not from the middle. And I agree, Mike, about the history issue. I think it's important that, yes, we taught STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, but we also left arts and sciences by the wayside doing that. And so you don't have people understanding how government works. People
civics
are not
isn't civic, taught
right.
widely
civics really
anymore.
Isn't taught anymore. People don't understand. I went to the doctor the other day, and the nurse, who's 20-something, wasn't registered to vote. And I was like, and my doctor only wants to talk to me about politics. And it's a riot. And I said, you have to register. Well, I said, do you want them telling you what to do with your body? Well, no. I said, well, here's my card and call me and I'll get you a registration form. But you have to register to vote. And people aren't taught that anymore. They're not taught the history. They're not taught to think critically. And that's part of this problem. And Trump really relies on the fact that people aren't taught to think critically anymore.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We welcome your letters. I don't know that we've gotten any yet, but we welcome your letters. Panel at W. It must be the day after a holiday.
Right, we're all sort of just,
Panel at WAMC.org or the mailbox is broken. But it doesn't matter. Just give us a shout. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. We are listening to artists. Hi.
Yeah, okay.
Good morning, artists. we're back on. Yeah,
we never stopped. Actually,
yeah. Well, that's all right. That's all right. But now you have to.
Okay.
Artists playing the Old Tone Music Festival in Hillsdale, New York. That's what we're listening to. The music, September 5th through the 8th, and you can find out more by going to oldtone.org. Oldtone.org. Playlist posted online, wamc.org/roundtable. All right, we do indeed have letters, so let's get to a few of them. Matt says, as your panelist was speaking about the Heritage Foundation taking applications to fill government positions in a potential new Trump administration, a thought came to mind. One of the most basic problems of Trump's first term was a complete lack of professionals within the administration. The people he brought in were ideologues for certain, who had ideas but also had absolutely no practical knowledge of how to implement those ideas within the framework of governance, which in large part was what made that administration an abject failure in most respects. That from Matt.
Well, one aspect of the Heritage Foundation's 2025 report is the they want to bring in people who know how to make fundamental changes in the way government works, who know the system, know the levers to push, and those people will be doing that in a way that will succeed in promoting and promulgating the policies that the foundation wants and that Trump has pushed in the first time in the presidency, only he didn't have the right people there to implement them. So I think it's a little more risky now. Mm-hmm. They recognize that what the writer says, and yet this time they said, we're not going to blow it this time. We know how to fix this. We're going to get rid of the, we're going to bring in loyalists to civil service positions, essentially.
One of the things that, to some degree, I don't want to say impressed me, that would be the wrong word, but amazed me about the Trump administration was its day-to-day level of energy that you just never knew what was coming out of this thing. And his it's as if he had a checklist, sort of like his weave, that was just, I'm going to do this today. I'm going to do that today. Let's do this. Let's do that. And you never, it was just coming at the country from all sides. And it was this kind of haphazard agenda. Imagine that agenda well organized and run by smart people.
Yeah. That's scary.
Yep.
Ooh, indeed. Let's go to Rick, who says, I can't tell you how happy I am that the Democratic Party and Kamala herself are not taking the bait from the mainstream media. The mainstream media continually takes Trump talking points and turns them into legitimate questions. They are not. She is staying on her message of positivity and better life for Americans. And he can scream and huff and puff, but she's not taking the bait. The Democrats have finally learned a better formula. She's using social media, and the rest of the main media is frustrated. But until they start asking actual questions about policy and the future of America and stop repeating right-wing talking points, I am with her. We have two esteemed journalists in the room today. I'd like to ask about that idea. We talked a bit about this last week about this notion of regurgitating the talking points into the form of a question, and some were saying that was something that was employed by Dana Bash on the interview on Thursday night. My point at the time is I'm interested in what the two of you have to say about this. My thought about it was, well, if you have an issue, and it's an issue, whether it's about Tim Walz or it's about Kamala Harris, and from no matter where it's coming from, if it has stuck to the wall or walls, that it is appropriate to ask that question to get a response and then move on, right? I mean, it's sort of what you do.
Unless it's ridiculous.
Yes.
The one I would cite would be the Hillary Kamala meme that went around about sleeping their way to the top.
Yeah.
Right.
You don't ask. You don't
or
need
turning
to
black
that.
Or whatever or, the yeah. case. Right. Okay. Yeah.
And I liked and your answer to that.
And if you deal with the too. Turning black one, then you explore it in an intelligent way. You don't explore it the way Trump wants it to be explored. Did Kamala Harris actually turn black? you know, right. The question is, how offensive can Trump get, and why did he say that? He said that because that's the way, you know, this is the kind of thing he does to gain attention. He is desperately trying to get the limelight away from her, and he's not doing a very good job of it.
But this was coming out, I think, in our Friday conversation about her position on fracking, and it came out on her positions of some the positions especially taken in the 2019 campaign that were very different from when she ran as vice president with Joe Biden in 2020. that seems fair, Mike, right?
Yeah, I mean, you always need to ask people about how it is that they have changed their positions on significant issues. In Pennsylvania, fracking is a big issue. It's elsewhere also. It's a big issue. And if you're talking about her full-blown support for the Bernie Sanders approach of Medicare for all, and now you're not. Now you're talking about, you know, enhancing the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and letting other health care plans coexist. I mean, I think she deserves an opportunity to explain why there have been changes. But that's only part of it. And I agree with Jay. I mean, there's ridiculous things that you just don't ask about, you know. And she did handle Dana Bash's question about Trump's really racist comments about her turning black, whatever that means. And she just said, we've been there already. Let's just move on. You know, I'm not going there. I think she's right to avoid the ridiculous things. But there are substantive questions that come out of the attacks from the other side. On the other hand, I think your writer has a good point. It's not all of what the media should be doing, and I don't think they are. They're asking about foreign policy. They're asking about her position on what's going on in Israel and Gaza. They're asking her position about Ukraine. They're asking her position about China. Those are all legitimate questions on the economy, on taxation, and those are obvious questions that you have to ask. On top of other key issues like reproductive rights, et cetera. So I think the media is doing its job. If they just focus on the attacks and turn them into questions, of course, that's failing to do their job.
I mean, they want to be able to ask questions of someone who can actually give them an answer compared to Trump, who doesn't.
Right. That is the irony here, isn't it, Libby? Because if there are attacks leveled by Democrats during the campaign on behalf of Kamala Harris or by herself, if they ask Trump about those, he'll ignore the questions and blather an attack. But
the other thing is that, I mean, is he pro-choice? Is he anti-choice? Is he going to vote for the Florida thing, Trump? Is he going to vote for the 6-week ban or isn't he? Does he want IVF or doesn't he? The press, part of his shtick is keeping everyone so off balance and saying something outrageous in the next 30 seconds that's the new shiny object and they can't go back to the ridiculousness of all the stuff he said previously.
All the while calling her a flip-flopper.
Right. All the while calling her a flip-flopper while she is trying to, which is part of the problem with Democrats, we think people are going to think logically. So she wants to give people the information. And, you know, but what they have been able to recognize, which is great, and George Lakoff has been talking about this, is the emotion. The emotion. People vote for president based on emotion. There's some, and even if it's choice, it's an emotional issue for many, many people. Right, that we have control over our own bodies. They have reframed the Democratic Party as the party of freedom. They have reclaimed it as the patriotic party, not patriarchal, but patriotic, and the flag and all of that sort of stuff. And so it's, you know, the press is still looking at what Trump is saying, but not necessarily focusing, I know we got to go, focusing on on the substance of what's really going on in the Democratic presidential campaign.
It's like the kid in class with his hand up.
I know.
Go to the bathroom, Joe? Is that what the story is?
No, I thought putting my finger through my neck was a sign that we had to go.
I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. It's good stuff. I don't know. In the meantime, I will figure out a way to pay Ray back for the time I have stolen from him.
Oh, he's fine.
No, he wants me to keep going. All right.
Good,
well, we'll take a break. We'll get news from Ray. We'll get back on track, and we'll return right after this.
It's been day after day, just while in the miles away, lonesome as a rambling boy can be.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love your thoughts on what we're talking about and the many situations that we brought up in our first hour. I'm going to get to those letters in just a few minutes. I just want to make sure that we have time to get some of the bigger stories here that I think obviously need mentioning. So Israelis stage a mass protest yesterday, a general strike, and the protests continue in Israel as Netanyahu faces outcry over hostage strategy. This is thousands of Israelis over 2 days stage the largest anti-government demonstration since October 7th, taking to the streets and joining a general strike Monday that brought much of the country to a halt as the last of the six hostages recovered from Gaza over the weekend was laid to rest. The killings of Israeli-American Hirsch Goldberg Pollin, or Pollin? But I believe it's P-O-L-I-N, so I think it's Poland, 23 years old, and five other hostages sent shockwaves throughout Israel, igniting fury among hostage families and their hundreds of thousands of supporters who have for months accused Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of torpedoing a deal in favor of political interests. So at the funeral, Pollin's father said that he had been let down by Netanyahu, and Netanyahu said an Israeli withdrawal from the area after the killing of the hostages would send Hamas a message: murder more hostages, you'll get more concessions. We look at this situation, this very complex situation, and try to make sense of any of this, which is difficult. In a rare hour-long televised news conference Monday evening, Netanyahu said that he was sorry he was unable to bring the six hostages home alive, but insisted that the Israeli military would remain along the strategic Philadelphia quarter on the Gaza-Egypt border, a demand that many say has delayed the conclusion of a deal that would involve the release of hostages. So doubling down.
Mm-hmm. Like someone else we know, right? And, I mean, they come out of the same playbook, Trump and Netanyahu. Double down, say whatever it is you think will play to your base, and don't pay attention to public sentiment. These six people were executed in the tunnel. If anybody thinks now that they can stand behind Hamas as freedom fighters, they're murderers. It's just that simple. They murdered 1,200 Jews on October 7th. There have been more dead hostages found, and this is just another example of their inhumane treatment. Netanyahu, on the other hand, has to go. I mean, it's very simple. If there was elections held today, he'd be thrown out of office. The issue is who would take his place and what coalition government would be put into place. Would the ultra-right wing of this country break apart and go with the middle and further to the left in order to bring peace back to Israel? Or will they just supplant Netanyahu with somebody even worse? And that's the question that we all have, and we don't have an answer to that.
You know, Libby, one of the things that strikes me is that 11 months ago, on the days following October 7th, we said, you said, and others on this panel, Netanyahu's got to go.
Oh, we've been saying it the whole
time. And Netanyahu will go. There's not going to. And here we are 11 right. months later. So what happened and what has not coalesced to push him, I guess push him out, but also to come up with the alternative government?
The Knesset has to call for new elections, and right now he controls the majority of the Knesset, and so that's going to be very, very difficult. But, you know, I lay all this at his feet, to be quite honest with you. He was too busy trying to take over the Israeli Supreme Court with right-wing folks and destroy the court and let their guard down on the border. And, you know, the idea, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, Israel and Mossad was vaunted that they would never let anything like something like this would ever happen. And they had, you know, the Israelis back and they had Israel's back and the whole nine yards and they were doing the right thing and Moshe Dayan and all Abba Iman, the whole thing. You know, and I was a kid. I was, you know, in 67, I was 9 years old, right, when that whole thing happened. Now that's just gone. That's just gone because they've let this political right-wing part of the country, which is basically the right-wing of the Jewish religion, the Hasidic community, the far right, take over. They're being told they have to serve in the IDF, and their demonstrations in the streets saying that they're not going to serve because they don't want to serve alongside women. Well, sorry, it's a pluralistic society, so get a grip. But, you know, Israel has been taken over by this right-wing coalition, and that's why we haven't been able to get rid of him. And the people need to stay in the streets. The strikes need to continue. Unfortunately, they may have to bring the country to its absolute standstill in order for anything to really happen.
Yeah, this idea that the I hope I'm not confusing my stories. The idea that the strike was political, it wasn't labor-related, so it has to stop. And labor's going, at least some unions are going along with it, I think, is missing a big point. You know, there's so much you can talk about every time you talk about this, and it's like you have to, and it's like our letters to the editor page. Once you start this discussion, it just, you know, it's history. And we go back to, you know, the Bible by the time we're done with it. And it's, you know, at least 100 years we go back. And it's all the wars being fought all over again and all the arguments being rehashed again. But I think we are, Israel and the United States as a supporter of Israel, an ally of Israel, are in a pretty binary choice situation right now. And the binary choice is, you know, forced and neither of these choices are good. And in some ways, neither of these choices are bad. But the binary choice is, do you negotiate with a terrorist organization that perpetrated October 7th and just shot a whole bunch of hostages in the back of the head in a summary execution? And, you know, or do you continue a war to eradicate them at the cost of probably tens of thousands of more lives? And this war is metastasizing, whether people realize it or not. It's metastasizing into the West Bank. And all the problems that existed before the war are only getting worse. That Netanyahu is expanding in the West Bank. He's, you know, all the bad policies are coming into play. And the problem is, I don't think Hamas wants to negotiate because Hamas has to go and everybody knows it. And I don't think Netanyahu wants to negotiate because this is, for better or worse, this is, war is great for politicians. I don't know how this ends. I really don't, because for Israel to negotiate a peace settlement somehow is either going to perpetuate Hamas or it's going to validate October. It's going to be perceived as validating October 7th. So I think ultimately you're right, Libby. I don't know what anyone is going to bring new to the situation, but I don't think Netanyahu is going to see it's just status quo with him.
Right. It's about staying out of jail. What I found interesting is over the weekend I saw a statement from the Global Imams Council, which is a council representing all the imams, and they condemned the barbaric actions of Hamas, the brutal executions of the six innocent hostages. They condemned the what happened on October 7th. So, you know, if this organization has any real oomph behind it, you know, we're starting perhaps to see a split within the Muslim community about all of this as well.
Well, I mean, many in the Muslim community have condemned this so far.
And they need to continue. Yeah. Because the only way Hamas is going to, and Hezbollah is going to, we're going to break their stranglehold on the West Bank and Gaza, is for their own people to rise up and to say no more.
Right. It's for the people of Gaza to step up and govern themselves
and
become involved in their future. And that has to be made possible by investment of a lot of resources, lots and lots and lots of resources, which is money and aid and food, and it has to get them back on their feet. It's a very difficult process, and it just becomes more difficult every day. But the peace accord that is being brokered right now seems very close, but cannot get to that final little 10% or so that needs to happen. And as you just said, and as others, like our esteemed co-panelist, you know, Ambassador Fred Hoff, has said last week, you can't get a settlement if Hamas doesn't want it and Netanyahu doesn't want it. And currently that's the situation.
That's right.
And it just seems untenable. So what do we do here in the U.S.? While we support Israel's right to exist and we support Israel in doing everything to counter the impact of the horrible October, you know, raid, what does that mean back here? I mean, President Biden, one word yesterday, is you know, Netanyahu doing enough? No. I mean, we're becoming increasingly dissatisfied, and it's going to be the presidential candidate, Kamala Harris, who is going to be asked, what are you going to do different?
Right.
How are you going to pressure? I mean, basically, how are we going to twist Netanyahu into or use every bit of influence we can to help Netanyahu get beyond this and let a peace accord happen?
England just said they're not going to send them anymore.
I know they're pulling away from our position.
Right,
we were ironclad.
And
up
I
till
think
now.
We'll and we said no to certain armaments. And I think we may see
a bigger
the U.S. saying no more. Or a cutting back, if not 100% no more, but a cutting back, you know, because it is becoming untenable here. And Trump is going to be, you know, like he'll give Netanyahu everything he wants because he's like, well, this wouldn't have happened if I was president. I'm like, yeah, right.
and
I have a bridge I'd like to sell
to both sides of that. Yeah. Of that binary choice, the way everybody is doing now. And I think, you know, it'd be nice to see a good, strong, coherent answer in a debate that's wise and could really be workable. But I think both of them fundamentally are going to give the same answer in that debate when they're asked. It'll be, we want to stop the hostages. We want to bring the hostages home. We want to stop Palestinians from being killed. And we want to bring peace. And nobody's going to take a chance before the election on figuring this out. And I think it puts Biden in an interesting fix that she will be either she'll be tarred with whatever answer or tarred. She'll be labeled with whatever answer he gives, or she will have to make a clean break from his policy. And I don't think he wants to put her in that position. So I think we're just getting, you know, that was a good answer. No, but, you know. What are you going to do? I don't think we're going to hear that for 2 months.
Well, I do agree with Libby, though. I think there's going to be a pullback of how much munitions. I mean, you don't need 22,000 ton bombs to be dropped on Gaza.
All right. Let's move on and talk about one other. We just have about 7 minutes or so before we move on here and have our bottom of the hour break. It goes quick, doesn't it?
It did go quick.
It does.
Yeah. So the other big story, of course, is out of Ukraine. Two ballistic missiles hit a military educational institution and a neighboring hospital in eastern Ukraine, according to President Volodymyr Zelensky. At least 41 people have been killed in that attack, in that strike. The Russian missile injured scores of others on Tuesday, Ukrainian officials said, in the latest in a series of devastating bombardments of Ukraine and one of the deadliest attacks of the 2.5-year war. Two ballistic missiles hit the military academy in a neighboring hospital in eastern Ukraine. 41 is the current number of those dead, 180 injured, and leaving people under rubble. President Zelensky said that the numbers are expected to go much higher. And the missile struck with a unforgiving quickness. The Ukrainian Defense Ministry reported that the gap between the sounding of morning sirens and the strike was so short that many people were killed on their way to shelter. Jay, what do you think of this?
Well, this may oversimplify things a bit, but I think to some degree we expect wars to involve minimal pain for civilian populations. And at the same time, I thought when Ukraine started making forays across the border into Russian territory, I thought that's the only way this is going to get resolved, because if all he has to negotiate with is, I'd like you, Vladimir Putin, to find some way to end the war, and Putin's going to say, well, I want some of your land. I mean, that's the way it's going to have to be, or we're going to keep fighting. So now, crossing the border at least raises the stakes for Putin, that he is saying, all right, if you get your people out of my country, I'll get my people out of your country. You know, I mean, it's a very that's not happening yet, but but this is to be, this was to be expected, that Putin was certainly going to say, I'm not going to tolerate you doing this. And in lieu of being able to stop them from crossing the border, he's going to start using, more aerial bombardment, mm-hmm. and people are going to get hurt. It's sad. It's horrible when civilian populations have to suffer because of this. But, if you're going to bring an end to this war, unfortunately, I think we're going to have to see a little more of this before we see an end to it.
Mike.
Yeah, it's painful because I think people are weary. People in the U.S. are weary of hearing about how this war is going on and on and on. And that fuels some to say, well, is this even winnable? Why are we even supporting Ukraine? Maybe we just should give some of that, broker a deal where Ukraine gives up some of its territories to Russia and just ends this awful war. And I understand that. I mean, war is a terrible, terrible thing. And yet, it does demonstrate also when you bomb a hospital and a school like in this latest attack today, where now it's closer to 50. I think 47 is the death toll now, they're saying. It demonstrates the cruelness of Vladimir Putin and his complete disregard for for civilian life or for any impact
for
that
any
his
life.
War is having. I mean, he's brutal, and if he doesn't get held back and the world and the West doesn't combine to help Ukraine push him back, you're going to be facing another effort to create a Soviet Union, and It's just staggering how we don't learn from the history. maybe that's another outcome of not studying history enough.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think we're, as we look at this, when we initially, as this war began, we all sat in this room and said, well, how long is it going to last? Is it going to be quick? Is it going to be? And I think a lot of people thought it was going to be over very soon.
Well, the United States offered to give safe passage to Zelensky, the president of Ukraine,
right,
thinking perhaps that Russia would just win and take over all of Ukraine. I mean, there were a lot of different opinions, and yet soon after the war got underway and it turned out that Russia really wasn't prepared for the, you know, they were prepared only for the immediate surrender of Zelensky and Ukraine, and that didn't happen, and that Zelensky pushed back effectively, I think then it began to sink in that this is going to be a long slog, and it is a long slog.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our panelists. We'll finish up for this Tuesday edition post-Labor Day, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. So nice to have you with us on this Tuesday, and we thank you for being here. Jay Jochnowitz, Libby Post, and Mike Spain joining us and making up the group. We have about 13 or 14 minutes together, and I promised this earlier, so I would like to go back to some of the letters that we got on previous topics and try to get as many in as we possibly can. Let's see. So because these are coming in at different times, they're sort of all over the place as far as where we topic-wise, but I'll try to group them together the best I can. John said, Republican Senator Tom Cotton said on Meet the Press that Israel, with Biden's help, should have been more aggressive in the fight against Hamas in the beginning of the war. How could they have done that when Hamas was holed up in tunnels under hospitals? That's from John.
They'll say anything to make the Democrats look bad. Yep. They just will. And facts be damned.
We go to Eliza. How are Palestinians to step up and organize politically when they have no money, nowhere to stay, no food, no water, no health care, no community buildings, no internet?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. It's going to take enormous support from, you know, Arab world, the Western world, and it's a tall order.
And you have an occupying terrorist organization. I mean, it's I would be terrified to be a freedom a true freedom fighter in this situation, where you come forward, you could get shot.
A peacekeeper would
and your family's going to get shot.
Kristen writes to us and asks, "What are the differences between Trump and Harris on the Israel-Palestine issue and foreign policy, as it would apply here?" Are there major differences?
Well, it remains to be seen. That is one of the big areas of speculation, whether Kamala Harris will break with the Biden administration on what the U.S. policy should be, and whether she would be more aggressive. I mean, she spoke about her support for Israel and Israel's right to exist and defend itself, and she spoke about the horrible plight of the Palestinians at the convention. But how does that translate? I think that's one of the questions that people are waiting to hear answered as this election winds down.
Speaking of the election, we have many letters about that portion of our conversation. Dave writes and says, stipulating that the Harris-Walz ticket wins in November and that the Democrats win majorities in the House and Senate, 60 votes in the Senate or not, doesn't matter. SCOTUS will stand directly in the way of almost any programs or laws that are at all center or left-leaning. I've not heard anything from Ms. Harris about the danger of the, about that danger and how she would address it.
Well, that's a discussion that's going to – it may come up in the election, but I think it's certainly going to come up afterward if indeed that scenario or some version of it plays out. If the Supreme Court becomes an ideological roadblock to Congress and the president, which it was never meant to be, you know, I think you're going to start hearing new talk about you're going to hear renewed talk of term limits, and you might hear talk of expanding the court.
Then we go to Eliza. Please don't fall into the Republicans corrupting our language by talking about the quote-unquote far left. There is virtually no far left in the U.S. Virtually no one is calling for socialism or communism, and most people could not define socialism or communism if their lives depended on it. Far left is used as a fear tactic returning to the 1950s.
Yes, I agree with the last statement. I disagree, however, with the fact that there is no far left, because there is a far left in this country, just like there's a far right. There always has been and there always will be. I mean, one of my relatives is part of the far left, and he's a socialist, and he can define it for you if you'd like.
But most Americans don't really
understand. Yeah, no. Most Americans don't.
Give me my Social Security. Give me my Medicare. Right. Give me this. Give me that.
But don't
bring us socialism.
Right. But, you know, but there is a far left in this country. And, you know, it might not be defined as the far left of what it was in the 20s and 30s. I'll give you that. But it is pushing against the Democratic Party, and it does exist.
And it considers any movement toward moderation or middle ground to be a sellout.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But look at AOC. Now she's come to the middle to a degree.
Somewhat. Yeah.
You know, somewhat. And she's been playing the game and understands that who this country is. I mean, if it can't play in Peoria, it's not going to go. And that's just the way it is.
AOC in Peoria.
Yeah, we have to understand. But we have to understand that in this country, that it's not just New York and it's not just the blue states.
We go to Stephen. Libby is the one who needs to think critically and ask a current or former teacher what really goes on in schools. As a recently retired high school English teacher, I can tell you that I stress critical thinking every day. Libby's comments are lazy thinking and taking cheap shots at teachers right at the beginning of another school year is not a good look. I must say I did not take it that way at all. But
and let's not forget I'm a professor at the university.
Well, I don't think that Libby's comments were an attack on teachers.
No.
I think it was attacking or at least criticizing the way we have allowed our curriculum to kind of push out civics classes and history classes in the effort to get more kids educated on STEM subjects, which is really important. But there's been a casualty to it, and we need to regain that balance. It's admirable that English teachers would teach critical thinking, and that may be one of the ways to expand the curriculum so that that is part of the automatic curriculum. Where it isn't, if it isn't there now, you know. But I don't think there's we not attacking teachers.
No, not at all. I mean,
Karen writes, Nicholas Kristof had a great column in the Times about how important it is not to demean Trump supporters. One of his many excellent points was that you're not going to get people to vote for Harris by demeaning them.
I think that was an excellent column. I urge people to go back and read it. He talked about a speech by Franklin Roosevelt that he gave in Albany in the 32 election about the forgotten man and how and used, you know, and FDR understood that, you know, the political leaders weren't paying attention to the people who were suffering across America. And that is how Trump rose to power. He spoke to them and spoke of their pain and while he didn't do a whole lot to ease that pain once he got there, he did get a lot of support because he does mouth their grievances.
We go to Gene. I understand what the far right wants, but I keep hearing the panel do both sides when mentioning, quote unquote, both sides, when mentioning the far left of the Democratic Party as if they somehow are the same. Can you give examples of what the far left is threatening us with? Taxing the wealthy, Medicare for all, funding schools. Most of the framing of things that are far left are actually popular in the United States of America.
Not voting in November. Okay.
What's that?
Not voting in November. There's a whole contingent. I mean, there was a movement during the presidential primaries to not vote, to stay home, for Democrats to stay home and not vote as a protest vote against what's going on in Israel and what they saw as Biden's complicity in it. And so that is still going on. So there you go. Not voting in November is a dangerous tactic to put out there, because all it will get us is Trump. And if anyone thinks Trump is going to be any better on any of our issues, they're wrong. And he will embolden Netanyahu, and he will up the military support for Netanyahu, not for Israel, but for Netanyahu, because they're both strongmen, and the whole Putin thing too factors into this in terms of strongmen as well. But that's part of the far left agenda right now, and that's incredibly dangerous. I'm all for everything else.
But I understand your point very much so. But hasn't a lot of that calmed down a bit since the change with from Biden to Harris?
I think that there are people who are waiting to hear what Harris has to say. And if she doesn't deviate from the present policy positions, you know, some people will stay home.
Hence the protest still at the convention.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it'll be dangerous.
You're not going to see Harris adopt something like open borders. And,
right.
and you know, as much as that is a trope on the right, it is, you know, there are people on the far left, and we don't hear from them as much because they're just not that numerous. But there are people that believe we should have an open border. So there are, you know, again, I don't disagree with fundamentally with what the letter writer is saying. The far left has not taken over the Democratic Party. The far right, unfortunately, has co-opted so much of the Republican Party that it's lost the middle.
One of the things that we only have about 2 minutes, but I'll throw this out, and one of you can answer it. Or give us your thought on it. But there was a piece in the Washington Post this weekend about why Biden isn't dragging down Harris, and that for all of the complaints, and this was a president who had dismal approval ratings, his ratings going into the debate and post-debate, but especially going into the debate, were dismal. One of the reasons he wanted to have the debate was to try to up those poll numbers that he had. You name his vice president, his vice president becomes the nominee of the Democratic Party, and those issues have suddenly dissipated and gone away a bit, and which I find fascinating. And is it as simply as it was the age issue all along?
I think the debate really underscored the age issue. I do think it was the age issue all along. She has energized younger voters. She has energized people of color. She has energized women, other constituencies. And I've been saying this all along, and the polls are starting to bear this out. Choice is going to be a pivotal issue in this election. Hence why Trump keeps belly flopping how he's going to vote on the Florida proposal of 6 weeks, a 6 week ban. Yes, to IVF, we're going to pay for it. And, you know, so, yeah, I think that the age issue was also the old white man issue. I mean, I think that had something to do with it, too. And Trump doesn't know what to do now, because he was banking on dealing with Biden and being younger than Biden and saying he was younger and more vital. And now he's up against a woman of color who's brilliant and can debate in a way, and who was a prosecutor. And so it's going to be a little bit different.
We're out of time. I want to. We have 15 seconds.
15 seconds. It's just ironic because one of the complaints about the Biden administration was that they weren't including Kamala Harris. They were wasting a great resource by not promoting her and having her involved in things. And in a way, that makes people not blame her for any of the things they don't like about Biden in a really weird way. It kind of frees her of that.
We'll end there. Mike Spain, Jay Jochtowitz, and Libby Post. So delighted to have you all here.
That's
we'll be
fun.
Right back.